plagued a potential nugget.
And the other thing I'm curious about is how leaders spend time, what their pie chart of time looks like. When you analyze his diaries, appointment diaries, when he was in power, and if you had to draw a pie chart, would you have a sense of what the big segments are in terms of how he would spend time?
Well, I mean, I can give you a, you know, morning, you know, from morning upma to night ragi story. But I don't think that's what you care about.
Right. But just what are the big themes, you know, as a leader, what are the kind of themes that take up time where he would prioritize?
Well, so I think for politicians, you have to put them in three categories when it comes to time. First is during election campaign. Election campaign is really the moments that galvanize parties, money pours in. You know, if you go to any party office and there's no elections, right, the party office is dead, you know. In fact, I once visited a party office in a district I don't want to name, when between elections, they would basically make it into a sabzi mandi. So they could get rent out of the office because no activity takes place around elections. So when around elections, politicians are very different. And that's when they really come to them. The mass politicians really come to themselves. They're traveling intensively. They're meeting hundreds of people. Money is pouring in. So I think that's one phase, right? Phase two is when they're in government, you know. And that is it's a routine which, you know, moves between. So when they're in government, they're typically not spending any time in their constituency. But the time in government moves between constantly dealing with files, like files and signing files and files moving up and moving down. You know, it's a daily job of politicians, right? And between meeting people, you're constantly meeting people, right? And a lot of times meeting a minister and meeting a prime minister is an end in itself. So you'll have like, you know, the, you know, secretary to the Dalai Lama coming and wasting your time for an hour. And you have to do it, right? And if it's less important, you can fob it off to a junior minister, but otherwise you have to do it, right? So in many ways, the Prime Minister of India is not just an executive head, is also a titular head. So there's no shortage of people, you know, the Independence Day, you know, martyrs of Indian Independence Association will call you for lunch. You got to show up there. If you don't, it'll be taken as a slight. So I think that's two, right? But the main thing a politician in government does is firefighting. You know, on the contrary to this view that the government of India or any government functions perfectly, you're there and every morning you wake up reading the newspaper, typically that's where you get your information and there's a new crisis. And you got to figure out how to react to it. So I think a key, especially in the Indian government, the state capacity being what it is you're frequently dealing with problems not of your making, which no one has warned you about, and you got to react very quickly, right? So I think that's broadly what the day looks like if you're in power. And when you're in opposition, you actually have a ton of time. You know, so some politicians take to painting, you know, others take to, you know, hanging around, making your way through the opposition party. So that I think that when you're in opposition, it's a different game. Narasimha Rao luckily had a ton of hobbies, you know, and he knew how to paint. He knew how to write. He was constantly learning languages. So he wasn't making foolish mistakes when in opposition. To give you an example, arguably the greatest politician Maharashtra has produced, a guy called YB Chavan, right? Who could have in any, you know, in a non-dynastic party could have been Prime Minister of India. Again, I may have got the facts wrong, so you should just check that. But in 1977, when Indira Gandhi loses very badly and the Janata government comes to power, if my memory serves, YB Chavan makes the mistake of rebelling. It's a problem because Indira Gandhi is back 3 years later and YB Chavan is now a rebellious man. Narasimha Rao could have also rebelled, you know, because everyone at that time was writing Indira Gandhi's political obituary. What does he do? He drives his own car to Jawaharlal Nehru University, enrolls in the Spanish languages department and learns Spanish, right? So, you know, often politics, because it's a marathon race, not a sprint, you have to realize in the lean periods that you shouldn't make stupid decisions, right? And the fact that Narasimha Rao had interests outside of politics meant that he wasn't morning to evening asking himself, how do I get to power? And that prevented him from making short-term beneficial decisions that would prove catastrophic in the long term.
And was it a certain theme to the curiosity, or was it just unfettered curiosity?
No, I think it was unfettered. You know, I mean, I have so many stories there that, you know, he sees a motor pump, you know, and he wants to figure out how it works, right? You know, when, you know, the then head of the nuclear program, the man who appointed Abdul Kalam, a guy called V.S. Arunachalam, went to meet Narasimha Rao when he became Prime Minister to talk about the nuclear program. Narasimha Rao wanted a drawing about, you know, where the, you know, what the bomb looks like, you know, where is the uranium kept, you know, just a simple map. So I think he fundamentally wanted to figure out how things worked. And that's very, and that coupled with the fact that he didn't have a narrow experience. He had such a wide range. You know, he was defense minister, he was education minister, he was foreign minister, you know, he was Hindu endowment minister, you know, in charge of temples in Andhra Pradesh. He was chief minister, he was prime minister, you know, gave him a really, really unique sense of how to apply your curiosity to very different fields. And I think there's a lesson there for people outside politics that if you want to rise to the top, know how different parts of your organization work. Or you should have at least a working knowledge, right? So if you're a CA by training, you shouldn't only have a finance sense of the organization, even if that's your core competency. You should have some sense about how different parts of your organization work. Because at the very top, you need to have some sense of that, you know.
And the other theme that came through very clearly in what you said, and even in the book, Vinaya, is resilience. And you spoke about Narasimha Rao almost becoming a monk.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, sort of making himself available for the biggest post in the country.
Yeah.
So talk to us about where he got the strength, you know, what made him resilient?
So it's hard to say, you know, because... So I can talk about his, you know, his family and his growing up, but there's a part of a human being that, you know, 2 + 2 in human beings is not always 4, right? So, you know, think of your best friend or somebody you know very well. You think you know them very well and you think you understood the components that made the person, but then they surprise you, right? So Narasimha Rao had, you know, it's hard to tell where he got this from, right? So, I mean, to give you another example of his resilience or shall I say his ability to surprise me was that he was a lifelong economic protectionist, right? Lifelong, right? So one thing he didn't know much about, and he was a protectionist. He didn't believe in opening the economy, right? He was very suspicious of capitalists. But when he becomes prime minister in June 91, and he realizes the scale of the economic crisis, within 2 or 3 days, he has changed his mind 180 degrees, right? And that's remarkable, you know? And it's not something I tried very hard to find out, you know, is it because his father treated him some way? Is it because he was served dinner? And I think that's useful as a biographer in trying to understand human beings. But sometimes human beings surprise you. And that, his resilience, his slight tangent to power, it's not easy to explain, you know. Is it his innate curiosity? Is it the fact that he also saw himself as a scholar? Or is it, which I believe the most likely explanation, he has interests other than power. He liked to paint. He liked to learn languages, right? You know, towards the end of his life, he wanted to ward off arthritis through his hands. So he learned to play the piano, right? And so he found meaning in things other than the immediate interest in power. And I think that is partly what gave him this tangential view of power, that I think greatly contributed to his understanding of it. You know, so to use the old Zen phrase, you know, he was in this world but not of it. So Narasimha Rao was in politics, but he was not of it.
The key takeaway for me was the point around unfettered curiosity that Vinay talks about. In the complex world we live in, I do think the leaders of today and tomorrow need to have depth in a certain space, but equally they need to have a working appreciation of a range of things across domains for them to be credible with their subordinates. In my earlier organization, Egon Zender, we'd look for 4 things when we look for potential. One was curiosity, which is growth mindset and having an openness to feedback. Second was insight, which was getting energy from connecting the dots across disparate canvases. Third was engagement, which is getting energy from people connections. And fourth was resilience, which is dealing with tough situations and grind through day in and day out. But even within these 4, the primary variable we looked for was curiosity. And as we move to a digital age where there are so many moving pieces, learnability possibly has a greater premium than what you've already learned and the capabilities you've already built so far. And this requires a very different mindset in terms of how you think about allocating time to various things you do. And I do think it makes sense to think about learning across the science and the arts end of the spectrum. Walter Isaacson, the author of the book Da Vinci, talks about how he was able to marry a scientific bent of mind with the heart of an artist to produce what he did. The future CEO is possibly going to need to take a leaf out of that book to be relevant. Thank you for listening. If you're new to the podcast and want to get a sense of the nature of the content that's covered, you might want to go to YouTube and type Play to Potential Highlights from 2017. There, I've tried to capture the key takeaways from my various conversations last year with leaders across disciplines. If you want to listen offline, say during a car ride home or during airplane travel, you could also access the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Savan, and several other podcast apps.
In fact, Google has also recently launched an app for podcast listening on Android platforms. If you went to playtopotential.com, you could also have the opportunity to listen to multiple voices curated by topic. To give you a sense, one of the playlists is Resilience. Guests talk about how they cultivated resilience and dealt with pockets of turbulence that they hit in their journeys. If you find the content purposeful, please go to iTunes, rate the show, and share a review. It will help others discover it. Thank you for listening.